Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Martin, and welcome to Eastern Standard, a service of WEKU, produced with the support of Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty and Dynamics Productions. There are more than a million children in Kentucky. They may be kids now, but before you know it, they will be our business leaders, our policymakers, health professionals, educators, and skilled trade workers. So if you're interested in what's in store for us in the years ahead, the Kids Count Data Book, produced by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, is a great up-to-date resource of information about how we're doing as a state in raising our kids. The 30th edition of the data book was just released. We have a copy, and here to help us with the highlights is Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates, and certainly no stranger to Eastern Standard. Greetings, Dr. Brooks.
Hey, Tom. Thanks, as always, for focusing on kids.
Well, I'd like to get started here by asking you to make the case for our listener to pay attention to what's revealed in this report. Why should they care?
Sure. As many of your listeners may know, Kids Count is in many ways the national report card on kids. I think as Kentuckians, there are two things that really jump out of the book. One is it gives us a chance to compare Kentucky to parallel states. I'm somebody that pays a lot of attention to West Virginia, Tennessee, and Indiana, more so than Connecticut and Oregon. So how does Kentucky compare to peer states? And then secondly, as you mentioned, the Casey Foundation, they partner with one group in each state. KYA is the Kentucky partner. And we work with the foundation to take a look at Kentucky compared to Kentucky. And that's what really animates me is looking at where we were 10 years ago or 7 years ago. Where are we today? So I think it gives folks on the ground, just regular moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas, neighbors, a chance to look at how kids in Kentucky are doing. We at Kentucky Youth Advocates use this data as a cornerstone of the kind of policy proposals that we hope we see coming in 2020 in the General Assembly. So, you know, we believe, as you said in your introduction, that kids are seminal to Kentucky's future. And this is hard data, it's longitudinal data, it's comparative data, and it really gives us a portrait of what it means to be a kid in Kentucky in 2019.
Okay, in terms of comparative data, and this is the 30th edition of the data.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What is Kentucky's overall ranking among states, and is that an improvement over previous years?
We are 34th currently, and that is somewhat of a status quo the last several years. 10-15 years ago, we were in the mid-40s, so much of Kids Count is what I call good news, bad news. The bad news is we're still in the bottom half of states in Kentucky, which no one can feel good about, but it sure is a lot better being 34th than 45th. There's generally a bright spot and a downside in almost every data point. But, you know, we are in that 34th range. The last few years, it's varied from 34 to 35 to 36. And that gives you sort of a general sense. Would not surprise probably your listeners that states in the Southeast and Southwest tend to come in at a lower ranking than states on the coast or in the North. So Kentucky fits a broader regional pattern. We don't stick out in terms of where we sit.
Okay, let's get into some of those trouble areas first, if you would. What tops that list?
I think the most good news, bad news item, and inevitably I always lead with this because I'm convinced that unless and until we pay attention to economic well-being, nothing else matters. The Kids Count book is organized into what they call domains, economic well-being, education, health, family, and community. We rank lower on economic well-being than, for instance, we do on education and health. But again, there's good news, bad news. No one can look at the data point around children in poverty and know that we have 223,000 little boys and little girls living in poverty in Kentucky. We can't feel good about that. By the same token, if you look at this identical data from 2010 to today, what we see is a decline of 15%. So that's terrific news. And so what I hope happens, whether it's your listener or a state senator or representative is we dig into those numbers and we figure out we're on the right trajectory. What could we do to be a catalyst? What could we do to propel that positive trend line even further? So I think when you look at economic well-being, it is such a mirror for what life is like in a family. For instance, another data point in that section is children whose parents lack secure employment. And secure employment is really full-time, year-round. Well, what we know is that more than one in three kids in Kentucky live in homes where neither parent has secure employment. That just is stunning to me. And what we know is that those moms and dads are not working. That's a double negative on purpose. Instead, what we know is they're working several jobs, part-time, minimum wage, no benefits. That paints a really dismal picture. I just painted a dismal picture of employment. The flip side is that particular data point has improved by 31% since 2010.
But so, you know, let me, if I may interject, what that data point doesn't capture is the level of stress that those parents and those kids are under in those conditions.
Well, and Tom, you think about the implications. If I'm a mom and I'm working two or three jobs, that probably suggests that there's a lot of time that my little boy or a little girl is at home alone or in other people's care. So just the day-to-day family dynamics that you could extrapolate from that one data point, as you very astutely point out, are so powerful. And so, again, without being redundant, what we always hope folks do is look at numbers and then look beyond numbers. So where do we stand? What's the trajectory? And then clearly the real question is, so what? What do we do about the numbers we see? And that's where, you know, action and really proactive responses come in.
One bright spot that I see in this report is a finding that 9 in 10 Kentucky high school students are graduating on time, and that's ranking the Commonwealth second in the country on that particular indicator. But there are also some bad news on the education front.
Well, you know, you just pointed out what I think is the headline in education. It is pretty easy these days to bemoan the state of public education in Kentucky. And yet, just as you said, in terms of graduation, we have the second best rate in the nation. That's profound. I think that that doesn't just happen. I think that you'll see, for instance, a number of things if you look below the surface. For instance, there has been a really positive movement in recent years around technical and post-secondary preparation, where if a young person wants to go to a traditional four-year university, that's terrific. We want to support that. But we also want to make sure that those students whose career track may take them more toward welding or HVAC or electrical work, that they have relevant experiences in high school that lead them there. And I believe that there has been a quiet, pervasive, and very important revolution going on among public schools where when you get to be a sophomore or a junior, the curriculum is becoming more and more relevant, that you see college-bound children taking more advanced program, dual credit classes. That's terrific. That gives them a leg up for college. By the same token, that young person who knows I'm going to be an auto tech and I'm going to make good money because that's a highly valued and highly skilled profession, I'm going to have experiences as a junior that whets my appetite for that. So we really need to celebrate that kind of progress. The idea that Kentucky is second best in the nation on an education item, those pre-CARA days, we never even dreamed of anything close to that level of success. I think it's a really positive trend line that folks from both parties and educators and business leaders are embracing the idea that in the world in which we live, those technical career path jobs are to be honored. They're not second rate. They're not second class. They just have a very different skill set, very different level of interest. And I think we're going to see that continue. And I think the more that that continues, the better results we're going to be. What I hope happens, and some progressive school districts have already done this, if I'm going into a certain kind of technical trades when I leave school, that may even suggest a differentiated curriculum, for instance, in math, that I need different kind of mathematical reasoning, thinking, and skill sets than if I'm getting a liberal arts degree. Well, that makes all kinds of sense. And the more we can bring relevance to core academic areas at a younger age, the better it's going to be for students and the better it's going to be for schools. And frankly, it's going to be better for our workforce as we get a better prepared, more aligned group of graduates entering our communities.
Terry, we have only about 2.5 minutes left, and I wanted to be sure to ask you to touch on your short list of policy recommendations that you will make based on the findings of the 2019 data book.
Well, if we want to focus specifically on economic well-being, since we spent quite a bit of time talking about that, you know, I think there's two or three, and frankly, you're going to hear us challenging Matt Bevin and Andy Beshear to both talk about a common agenda for kids and economic well-being. They can disagree on so many things, but when it comes to some very simple, very bipartisan solutions, we want to see in 2020 a state refundable earned income tax credit passed. Absolutely an essential anti-poverty tool nationally. It's good for families, it's good for local economies, and it's good for the state budget. We want to see Andy Beshear and Matt Bevin say that they're both going to tackle the unacceptable climate of predatory lending in this state. That is an issue that is crippling Kentucky families in every region. We can pass smart policies to begin to curb that. When you think about what is already happening in terms of more affordable, accessible, and higher quality child care, that has a direct bearing on economic well-being and workforce capacity. So we would suggest that there are those kind of solutions in health and education as well as economic well-being. But when it comes to really tackling childhood poverty in Kentucky, again, that's not a rural or urban or Republican or Democratic divide. We want that common ground, common sense solutions, and we believe that the momentum is on the side of families, and we hope we can see some of those very tangible wins come 2020.
Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Terry.
Tom, thanks again for paying so much smart attention to kids.
Up in the morning and out to school, the teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math, you study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone, and the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
Coming up after the break, as many as 1 million species of animals and plants at risk of extinction, many soon.
It's what sustains all life on the planet.
Greg Abernathy of the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust, here to help us look at a UN report through a Kentucky lens. Later in the hour, Miranda Lash from the Speed Museum in Louisville, and Jeremy and Lindy Franklin Smith from the Lexington Theater Company. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th to 21st, 2019 in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
On May 6, the United Nations warned that nature is declining globally at rates unprecedented in human history, and the rate of species extinctions is accelerating, with grave impacts on people around the world now likely. Compiled by 145 expert authors from 50 countries over the past 3 years, with inputs from another 310 contributing authors, the UN report assesses changes over the past 5 decades, looking at the relationship between economic development and impacts on nature. The 1,500-page report is the most exhaustive look yet at the decline in biodiversity across the globe and the dangers that that creates for human civilization. So we wanted to process this information through a more local lens to give it a Kentucky context. Joining us to help with that is Greg Abernathy, Executive Director of the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust based in Berea. Thanks for coming in, Greg.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I truly enjoy your program and honored to be here to have this conversation today.
Well, thanks for being here. And first, if you would help us define something, the term biodiversity. We hear it often.
Sure.
But rarely do we hear it actually defined. Could you do that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So biodiversity is the variety of all living things and their roles and connections within ecosystems. We often hear it simply put as the web of life, which is a really poetic way to say it, but it's a very complex thing if you really dig into it. And if we can take a minute, I'll go through it. It's really three primary levels when we think about biodiversity. At the foundation of the web of life is genetic diversity. So this is the diversity within the genes of individual species. The next tier of biodiversity is considered species diversity. So this is the diversity of individual species, whether that's a black bear or a luna moth or a green salamander or a hemlock tree. So areas that have similar groupings of species on the landscape have been classified as natural communities. And it's the diversity of natural communities scattered over the larger landscape that gives us the third level of biodiversity, ecosystem diversity. So if you think about this repeated over and over, from genetics to species to ecosystem diversity, this is what is happening around the planet, and it's what sustains all life on the planet.
And it's interesting, there's kind of a dichotomy, I guess, between that diversity and ecosystems, since in an ecosystem, everything is related.
Absolutely. Yeah. The what we find on the Earth today is ecosystems and communities that have sort of come together over the last 10,000 years of a relatively stable climate, and these assemblages of species have found ways to kind of collaborate and work together and coexist and offer the support systems upon which we all depend.
So I referenced this UN report that came out in early May in the introduction, and I'm just wondering, when you saw this, what were your initial thoughts?
It's absolutely startling. I mean, I think everyone should take a look at it. They've only released the summary, so we haven't even seen the full report. But it's very, very startling, and it should be very concerning, and it should get even more coverage than it's already got. I was pleased to see it picked up around the world. But to think that 1 million species could be on the pathway to extinction, and some in the coming decades, it's really beyond belief. And to put that in context, that's within the report. They looked at about 8 million species, primary major groups. 2.5 million are plant and animal species, and 5.5 million are insects. So this is almost 1/8 of species on the planet that are on a pathway to extinction under the current conditions.
And if you want to see this report, I've found that if you simply Google UN extinction, yeah, it will come up. Unfortunately, right, that is the combination that brings it up. Well, this report was compiled by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, and the chair, Robert Watson, said, quote, "We are eroding the very foundations of our economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and quality of life worldwide." And he goes on to call for transformative change, and some might portray that as a bit overdramatic. What's your take on it?
I think he's absolutely correct. And if you really reflect on what we were just talking about and what biodiversity is, it's foundational to all life on the planet. And there's this these services that it provides that are defined as ecosystem services. And if you really reflect on the ecosystem services that biodiversity provides us, it transcends every aspect of our ability to live on this planet, from regulating the climate to giving us food to eat, water to drink. It keeps us balanced both mentally and physically. Our health is absolutely associated with intact biodiversity in wild places. There's an ever-growing and long laundry list of all the things that it provides to us. So it is really fundamental to our own species able to survive on this planet.
Biodiversity on a global scale is a little challenging to wrap our brains around, but I wonder if you could bring this home a bit and tell us about Kentucky biodiversity.
Sure. Kentucky is actually quite an amazing place. We have a really fantastic natural heritage here that I encourage everyone to learn more about because it's quite astounding. Recent studies and documentation has put the number of species in the state around 19,400 documented species. Over 80% of those are insects, which is a reflection of common across the world. And they make a massive contribution to biodiversity, and that includes dragonflies and butterflies. But there are a few groups in the state that really rise to notable levels, particularly our aquatic fauna in Kentucky. The Southeast is incredibly rich in aquatic species. In Kentucky, we actually rank third in the nation for the number of freshwater fish, fourth for freshwater mussels, and fifth in crayfishes. And if you think about it, Kentucky has a phenomenal amount of waterways. There's 90,000 miles of streams from the mountains in eastern Kentucky to the swamps and the sloughs out in western Kentucky. So a lot of diverse habitat. We're sitting in within the fourth largest watershed on the planet. But also notable is our subterranean fauna. Kentucky's fifth in the nation for the number of subterranean species that occur here. There's 3,100 documented caves, including Mammoth Cave, the nation's largest cave. We're also sitting in what's considered the most biologically diverse region on the planet for salamanders. Kentucky has 33 documented salamanders in the state. And then the last thing I'll mention is that eastern Kentucky in particular sits within central Appalachia, which is part of the mixed mesophytic forest. And so the mixed mesophytic forest is the second most biologically diverse timber zone forest found on the planet. That's a lot to unpack there. Of course, the tropics are the most diverse forest we find. But in the temperate zone, central Appalachia has the second most diverse. The most diverse forests are found in Southeast Asia. And the reason they're more diverse is there is a greater elevational change in that topography, in that geography.
About 100,000 acres of southeastern Kentucky and northern Tennessee forest land recently came under the ownership and protection of the Nature Conservancy. Do you see that as a positive step toward preserving the biodiversity of the area?
Absolutely. It was quite a monumental task that the Nature Conservancy pulled off, and it's in a very biologically important and climate-resilient landscape. So the steps that they'll be taking with that land will greatly add to advancing conservation in the region. It's complementary to work we've been doing on Pine Mountain for decades. And I think we'll get into this, but it's part of a diversified portfolio of how large landscape conservation works, a mixture of preservation of land and a combination of working land conservation.
We will get into that in just a second. I want to go back to that UN report for just a moment. It finds that around 1 million animal and plant species are now threatened with extinction, many within decades. And that's more than ever before in human history. Do you have data on the number of extinct or at-risk species here in Kentucky?
Yes, I do. I do. I'm familiar with that data. Just for reference, in Kentucky, the Office of Kentucky Nature Preserves is the entity that leads up tracking rare species in the state. And so some of the recent numbers that they've put out are that there are 18 species that were once found in Kentucky that are no longer found on the entire planet. So 18 species have been extirpated already from the planet that once occurred in Kentucky. There's another 36 species that are considered extirpated. And extirpation means they still exist on the planet, but they're no longer found in Kentucky. So the range, they used to occur here, but they are no longer here. And then the more startling number is that there's over 700 species in Kentucky that are considered to be on the brink and headed towards a path of extirpation or potentially worse, extinction. So the percentages where we talked about the global numbers being about one-eighth are not quite as stark in Kentucky, but we are seeing unprecedented strain and stresses on our biodiversity here in the state.
How does Kentucky compare with surrounding states when it comes to land conservation?
So Kentucky, if you look at Kentucky, we've got 26 million acres of land. And if you consider a broad approach to what is a conservation land, that would include federal lands, such as a national park, but also military bases, state lands that might be state parks, wildlife management areas, local lands like Raven Run or Jefferson Memorial Forest, or groups like Kentucky Natural Land Trust, Our Lands, or Bernheim Forest. So if you look at all of that collectively, a little over 7% of the state is in some form of conservation land protection. If we look at the surrounding states around us, Kentucky ranks below all of them in our investment in public lands. There's a couple takeaways from that. Is one that, you know, there's a greater need to finance and invest in conservation lands, but also over 90% of the state is in private ownership. So finding creative ways to partner with landowners is essential to advancing conservation on the ground. There's a lot of people, a lot of small acreage landowners that are passionate and committed to their land. So finding mechanisms to help those landowners with better improved management is another tactic to address biodiversity.
Speaking of that, then, your organization, the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust, has a project underway on Pine Mountain. If you would tell us about the Pine Mountain Wildlands Corridor.
Sure. So Kentucky Natural Lands Trust launched in the mid-90s upon the discovery of a really large tract of old-growth forest in the state right outside of Harlan. They ended up working with the State Nature Preserves Commission to establish Blanton Forest, the largest tract of old-growth forest found in the state. Upon the success of that project, the group sort of pivoted to a broader scope than looking at large landscape conservation around the state, but particularly focused on Pine Mountain, where Blanton Forest was found. Pine Mountain is an absolutely exquisite part of our natural heritage here in the state. It's a 125-mile ridge that runs from Tennessee through southeastern Kentucky up to Virginia. It's 180,000 acres in size. It has one-seventh of the rare species known from the state are found on it. It's primarily intact forest. The geologic history of the mountain is such that there's not merchantable coal, so there hasn't been a lot of land use pressure on the mountain. It's the headwaters of three major rivers that feed into the Ohio and the Mississippi. It's just an absolutely exquisite place. It's also a place where there's been it's a really interesting public-private partnership in that there's a mixture of state and federal lands and a mixture of nonprofit lands that collectively have resulted in protecting about 65,000 acres. So about just under 40% of the mountain right now, if you look at the whole total acreage, is under some kind of conservation protection currently.
We just have about a minute left, and I want to go back to something in that UN report, that call for transformative change. Do you, Greg Abernathy, do you think we are capable of achieving that?
I have to hope that we are. I think that if we really take a pulse and perspective on what our priorities and needs are, that we really, if we reflect on what biodiversity is and what it does and provides for us, that we'll find a pathway forward that's a more balanced and equitable and just future that's way more sustainable than the way we've been operating as a species. I think it's essential for our state. It's particularly essential in eastern Kentucky as the economy's diversifying and looking for a just transition for the communities there.
Greg Abernathy is Executive Director of the Kentucky Natural Lands Trust. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I hope you'll come down and join me for a hike on Pine Mountain.
I plan to. Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. After the break, Art Sheckett sits down with Miranda Lash, contemporary arts curator at Louisville's Speed Art Museum, and a look at Lexington's pipeline to Broadway. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com.
Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let them do what they can. You've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own.
The Lexington Theater Company's Jeremy and Lindy Franklin Smith are here. Jeremy and Lindy, welcome back to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much. We're so glad to be here.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. The Lexington Theater Company's fifth summer season is underway with rehearsals for a production of West Side Story. You have a production of Disney's Newsies on tap for August, and that's a full summer of many spinning plates for both of you, for everybody that's involved. Before we talk about the shows themselves, a moment or two on just what goes into this, if you would. Tell us about the many elements that have to come together to make it all work.
Well, we start planning for the summer season literally within days of the ending of the previous summer season. There's so many things that go into it. It takes a full year. I think I'll let Jeremy start first because he handles a lot of the logistics side of things. So, Jeremy, maybe you can kick it off.
Yeah. It takes a lot for us to figure out even what titles that we're going to do. Because right now we are not building sets or building costumes, although this year is the first year we're designing costumes for West Side. But so we have to find the titles that we want to do. We have to find a set that's going to fit in the opera house that's going to work. We have to, you know, secure the rights for those things so that we're ready to go. And then from there, it's just building the team. Also figuring out the logistics of where we're auditioning, when we're auditioning, the logistics of where they're gonna, people are gonna stay whenever they get here, the travel, the list of things kind of goes on and on and on, but it is spread out over the year, and when it all comes together, it's just a magical time to be a part of, and not just the performances, but the space and the people all coming together to create these shows.
So I touched on the mission of the Lex in the introduction, but I want to kind of drill down into that for a moment, because this is what's fascinating about it. It's not just what you're seeing on stage there. It's everything backstage, and it's this collaboration between not only just local talent, but high school level, collegiate level, regional theater level, national level. And the networking that must come out of that must be pretty incredible.
Absolutely. Well, it's sort of what we set out to do from the beginning. Not only do we want to create high-quality professional theater, but we're also really centered on being a training ground for the next generation of musical theater artists. So our Broadway talent, seasoned pros coming in from New York, they serve as a mentor to the younger students. And by younger, I mean collegiate. Many of our collegiate ensemble are literally steps, days away from moving to New York City to pursue the same dream. So there's certain pieces of the puzzle that we can kind of help put together for them. Sometimes it's that connection that you're talking about, just meeting somebody who's going to open a door. Sometimes it's putting into practice what they're learning at school. Sometimes it's just that confidence building scenario where they're like, hey, I am in a rehearsal room with a Tony nominee. Like, I can hang. I can do this. And a lot of the students, that's what they say, you know, is all of my dreams seem a little bit more within my grasp once I've spent time at the Lex.
This is your fifth year at this. Is the Lex becoming known for this kind of production?
It's so exciting. Yes, we are. It's our audition numbers have grown exponentially over the years. And what was so exciting this year was we had college students literally getting on airplanes and flying across the country to come to one of our audition cities. The word has spread throughout the New York City scene, throughout the college musical theater scene, that the Lex is one of the places to be in the summertime. And so that is just thrilling. And we just hope that our Lexington community is starting to recognize what a treasure this is and what a destination we are becoming for the Broadway talent and for the soon-to-be Broadway talent.
Okay, the shows that you have coming up. First, West Side Story. Tell us about the variety of levels of talent and how you bring them all together for this particular show.
So we have four seasoned New Yorkers coming in for the show. Among them, Colton Ryan, who's actually a Lexington native, SCAPA graduate, and made his Broadway debut in Dear Evan Hansen. He's coming home to lead our company and play the role of Tony. And then we have an incredible group of college students and recent graduates who are going to sort of round out most of the ensemble. And then we have a great group of local actors who are going to be joining us as well. One of the neatest stories, I think, is Paul Thomas, who's a longtime drama teacher over at SCAPA. He was actually Colton's teacher at SCAPA, and he's going to be playing Doc, who serves as a mentor to Tony in the show. And I cannot wait to watch the two of them in rehearsals and in performance together. It's just going to be magical. And we have a couple of current high school students who are joining the company as well. So it's a wide range of ages. It's a wide range of sort of where they are in this stage of their artistic journey. And it's going to be just a stellar, stellar company.
And that show's directed by Mark Madama, who directed our last season's Music Man. But he's a professor of musical theater at the University of Michigan. He's a dear friend and mentor of ours. And then the choreography, we're doing the original Jerome Robbins choreography, and that's being staged by Mark Esposito, who has been doing that choreography for years. He was actually a member of the Jerome Robbins Broadway company, and now he is a choreographer traveling all over the country and specializes in that work.
Later in the summer, August 1st through the 4th, Disney's Newsies. And will some of the cast and crew from West Side Story hold over for that as well?
Yes, there's a good portion of the collegiate ensemble that will do both shows. It's part of the mission by giving them the opportunity to experience a couple of different creative teams, a couple of different titles and styles of musicals. That's part of the educational process for them. But then we'll have a whole new group of guest stars coming in, including Dan DeLuca, who was the Jack Kelly, the leading role, on the first national Broadway tour of Newsies. So he's going to be reprising that role for us. Tessa Grady, an amazing Broadway veteran, is going to play opposite him. We have another fantastic group of local actors, some different ones from West Side Story and some of the same that will do both shows. So, yeah, it's going to be super fun.
Well, I would have to think for two people who have background in New York on Broadway that this has to be incredibly rewarding work.
Oh, it's so rewarding. I there's really no words. And we say all the time that, you know, our greatest dream is just to have the biggest impact that we can on the industry, to preserve the craft, to make sure that live theater lives on for as long as it possibly can. And it feels like the work that we're doing here at the Lex is the best way that we can play the role that we want to and feel that we are really making a significant impact in the industry. So it's exciting.
And also for this community, we look at this as a way to paying it forward and bringing something special to Lexington and Central Kentucky. And this is what we have spent our life doing. It's what we love to do. And now we're getting to provide something really special and wonderful for Lexington.
Okay, how can people see this? Tell us about tickets.
So you can get your tickets at the Lexington Center ticket office, 233-3535, or visit our website, lexingtontheatercompany.org.
Lindy Smith, Artistic Director, Jeremy Smith, Producing Director of the Lexington Theater Company, better known as The Lex. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maria, I just met a girl named Maria, and suddenly that name will never be the same to me. Maria.
At first glance, it looks like a library, an extensive one, and very colorful. But then, on closer inspection, you discover that this exhibit at the Speed Art Museum in Louisville is, fittingly, telling a story. We get the details of it, and other big happenings at the Speed, from the museum's curator of contemporary art, Miranda Lash. She sat down with Undermain's Art Shackett.
Hey, Miranda. Thanks for joining us today.
I'm thrilled to be here, Art.
Well, let's talk about a couple of major shows that you have going at the Speed Art Museum these days. First, I'd like to talk about the show and whole room exhibition by the British-Nigerian artist Yinka Shonabare.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell our listeners something about the artist?
Sure. So Yinka Shonabare was born in London in 1962, but was actually raised in Lagos, Nigeria, and he considers himself British-Nigerian. And also identifies very much as a cultural hybrid, as an artist that has been informed by both British and Nigerian culture. He completed his artistic training back in London. And something interesting about his name is that it always concludes with the letters CBE, or Commander of the British Empire. And, you know, it's funny, in the process of preparing for this show, I had known him for years as Yinka Shonabare MBE, Master of the British Empire, and he got an upgrade actually just a few months ago. So we changed all the texts to accommodate this. But to him, it's significant to include this honorific title, A, to signify that the highest power in England has recognized him as an artist of color for his artistic prowess. But also for him, it calls out the colonial relationship between Britain and Nigeria. And that's a theme that really plays out throughout his work.
Yeah, he's been his work is a lot about colonialism and identity, cultural and political and national identity, and ideas about that and challenges to those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell us something about his work?
Sure. So the most identifiable element about it is his use of Dutch wax cloth, which is a very vibrantly colored patterned cloth. There's almost a seemingly infinite number of patterns. The Dutch wax cloth he uses is produced by a company known as Vlisco. For him, that type of cloth signifies, I guess, the meeting of cultures, because its history is one of British and Dutch traders going to the South Pacific, seeing the Indonesian batik textiles, thinking those batik textiles would be profitable to sell abroad, and producing essentially a more inexpensive method known as Dutch wax fabric. So interestingly, the market that was most attracted to these fabrics was in Africa. So today people see Dutch wax fabric and associate it with Africanness, although its legacy has, you know, influence from Europe and the South Pacific. So Yinka Shonabare, when you see his work, you'll see, for example, mannequins dressed in cloth that is made of Dutch wax fabric that's cut in the style of English fashion. So, for example, in Edwardian fashion or Victorian fashion, or as in the case of American Library, you'll see thousands of books wrapped in Dutch wax fabric.
And some of these mannequins are kind of fantastical creatures.
Yes.
What's the meaning of that in terms of what he's trying to represent?
So some of them are reenacting mythological tales or famous classical sculptures. The narratives often, as you said, have to do with the legacy of colonialism. So, for example, there's an artwork in the show known as Food Fairy, which is on loan to us by one of our partners in putting this on, 21C Museum Hotels. And Food Fairy looks like almost like a winged cupid. He's dressed in an outfit made of Dutch wax fabric, and he's sort of leaping as if taking off into the air with wings behind him. And he has a basket of mangoes trailing behind him. Oh, and I should say, by the way, all his mannequins are headless, which is usually a surprising element for most people. But in a way, it makes them metaphorical characters rather than specific. But the idea of a food fairy, the idea of resources being taken from one place, delivered to another, very much taps into that story of colonization.
Now, the Speed has installed the American Library. Tell us about this whole room installation that really the Speed has dedicated a significant space to.
Yeah. Well, for us, it was actually, in a way, emotionally significant, the room that we chose. So the library of over 6,000 books, and I can explain in a minute why we don't know exactly how many books there are, but is installed in what was known as the book room in 1927. So in other words, when the museum opened its doors, Hattie Bishop Speed included her own library as part of the museum. And so, and we have photographs dating from the late 20s of what it looked like with these inset shelves. And so we thought it was meaningful to once again make that space a library. And I always thought it was very special the way Yinka Shinabari described his desire to create a library to discuss the subject of immigration. And that is because he says when people travel and when they migrate and they pick up and leave everything behind, really the most important thing they bring with them are stories. And so America as a country, we're made of this sort of aggregate of thousands of different stories. And so he thought a library would be the best metaphor to touch on that and also to signify learning. We need to educate ourselves on what being American is.
So the library has these books, these mm-hmm. volumes of books covered in this rich, colorful Dutch wax fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And there are names on the books.
Yes.
On many of the books.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So on many, many, many of the books, there are names written in gold on the spines of the books. And these names are very specifically chosen to identify people who are first or second generation immigrants to this country, or people whose ancestors participated in the Great Migration, or there's three categories. People who are vocally opposed to immigration. And all of these names are mixed together. There's no prescription as far as who gets placed where. And some of the names are very recognizable, though people might immediately recognize Barack Obama or Steve Jobs or Dr. Ruth or Oprah Winfrey, but they may not recognize the name of a famous physicist or a famous congressman who was an immigrant, whose parents were immigrants. So to help people sort of navigate who all these names are associated with, there are iPad stations, four of them, located on tables within the library. Again, it has a very reference library feel to it. And you can look up any of these names alphabetically and read about their biography. I find it incredibly educational. So, for example, one of my favorite singers, Paula Abdul, I had no idea her parents were from Syria. So there's often people find a lot of surprises, and it definitely shifts the way you think about certain individuals. You might have known them, but you don't think of them as immigrants. And in that sense, I think it's a very illuminating piece.
So you can spend a considerable amount of time in the exhibition itself doing research work on these mm-hmm. various folks that are whose names are on the books themselves.
Yeah, actually, we found some people want to have fun only identifying, for example, musicians, or only identifying scientists. And because there's so many books, you can actually you can find one name. And sometimes I return to the library days later and be like, "Where's John Lennon? I can't find him anymore." But we actually had a fun putting him next to Yoko Ono.
Well, you have a couple of special events that are associated with this exhibition, which runs into September.
Mm-hmm. Yes, September 15th.
Uh-huh. Tell us about one or two of those events.
Sure. Well, I think one of the most exciting and meaningful ones for us will be a naturalization ceremony, which takes place on Friday, August 9th at 11 a.m. And we're working with the city of Louisville. We're welcoming 100 Louisvillians to become citizens at the Speed. And this is something we're very excited about. So it's open to the public. Anyone who wants to participate in welcoming people to their citizenship, we encourage folks to come. We've also had a great partner with University of Louisville's Cultural Center, the Hispanic and Latino initiatives within the Cultural Center. And what they've done is they've put together for us a series of talks known as Borders and Movement to help educate the public on this very complex issue. So the second in our series will happen on September 8th. And that will be preceded by a talk, a keynote by Dr. Teresa Keeley, who's going to talk about U.S. foreign policy in Central America. Because I think not everyone understands that one of the reasons we have so many people from Central America endeavoring to enter the United States is directly tied to actions taken by the U.S. in previous decades to upend democratically elected governments and instate and you know, essentially stage coups. And so this will be followed by a moderated discussion with Latino advocates led by Sarah Nunez and La Casita Center. So we're very excited about that.
Well, that's a fantastic array of possibilities that people can take advantage of at the Speed Museum in Louisville. And I just want to move on now to quickly to another exhibition that you have, mm-hmm. which is an installation on the second floor of the contemporary wing of the work of Ebony Patterson. Ebony Patterson, of course, was faculty at the University of Kentucky and herself immigrated from Jamaica.
This installation is so gorgeous, I can't even tell you. So we converted the entire second floor to a night garden environment, and that entails floor-to-ceiling floral wallpaper, thousands of silk flowers and butterflies, vines hanging from the ceiling, and all of this is part of adorning her beautiful, very elaborate tapestries, works on paper, sculptures, video rooms that'll be part of the installation.
And Ebony also is concerned with issues of culture.
Yes.
And the mixing of cultures, but she also celebrates her Jamaican origins and the culture of Jamaica and the Caribbean islands.
Yeah, so definitely she's inspired by the history of Jamaican dancehall culture as part of her work. But I would say one of the most important issues that's addressed in this exhibition is the issue of violence against people of color. So when you look at her tapestries, you'll often find, I should say, the garments of a figure or whose skin has been erased. So in other words, you might see evidence of a figure present in the tapestries, but not the complete body. In a strange way, that this connects her work to Yinka Shonabare. But the bodies that are often being alluded to are bodies that have experienced violence. And so the environment of a garden is meant to create a space for contemplation, mourning, and memorialization.
And when will that exhibition wrap up?
That'll wrap up on January 5th. So it has a
nice long run. That's excellent. Mm-hmm. So people can really come and spend time at the Speed Art Museum in Louisville, and they can go to spend time in Yinka Shonabare's American Library and also see Ebony Patterson's installation on the second floor. We appreciate you coming by and talking with us, and we look forward to more discussions about all the exciting things happening at the Speed Art Museum in the future. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Art.
That's Art Checkett, co-publisher of the online magazine Undermain, with Miranda Lash, contemporary arts curator at the Speed Museum in Louisville. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of Alltech, working together for a planet of plenty. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu or call and leave voicemail at 859-622-WEKU. That's 622-9358. We might include your thoughts in a forthcoming edition if that's okay. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.